This is work, you know. I mean, actually, they pay people lots of money for this sort of thing. I don't know why. I want to convey some things that we've already covered, but I wanted to review because of our class. Because these are concepts that have come on down from a long time ago. I keep trying to relate history to the present. Yes, sir.
I hate to interrupt. Can I make an announcement?
Yes.
Rosetta World is going to give a talk on subsistence this Wednesday, 1 o'clock.
I heard that she wasn't coming. That's what Williams Boy? Who?
Peter,
yeah. He mentioned something about just as I came down. I hope you don't mind if I take my shoes off.
All depends.
Yeah. I might want to give you a high-kicking demonstration. What you laughing about? You act like I don't even know how to kick. Everybody's getting organized on their papers, I gather. Don't forget that concept of Indian country, okay? That was developed back in the beginning in 1763 or even before that. It was an area specifically set aside for non-whites. Right? Remember that line that went from Canada to Florida? That idea of separation, the attempt to try to separate because the unconscious or the conscious idea was that they had to be separated in order to, their ways were so different they had to be separated, right? In an Indian country there are specific rules for traders and settlers normally. There's that land beyond the pale where the whites controlled and the Indians did, so to speak. And in reality, though, it was not only a way to organize the taking of Indian lands, it was a way to try to keep the settlers there, right, where it was already settled, so that they could sort of build up their economy and the businessmen wouldn't lose all their people, right, who would go back into Indian country. So it was a way, in effect, to try to not only keep the peace, you know, by making sure that the settlers don't go offending the Indians, but it also was a way to try to keep the Indians there to, or the whites there to keep the, to settle the territory, build up the land, and maintain their communities. This idea of Indian country also eventually ended up being something that, well, developed this idea of trust land, you know. And also eventually land that was, as opposed to just plain old use and occupancy. The non-native began to say, well, you have the right to use and occupy it. You know, but ultimately, we own it. Right? And this trust land was that, well, we own the land, but you can occupy it. And, of course, later on, this land that was used and occupied then became compensable, ultimately. That is, they could be reimbursed by the federal government at some point in time later for the taking of that land that they formerly used and occupied. And this, of course, was developed into ultimately the Indian Claims Commission, which heard all these claims. Prior to that, it was the Court of Claims.
Could you go through that progression again? That was a question.
Yeah. this kind of goes back to this whole idea as to that they had when they first showed up in the New World, both in America and Central America. Just what rights do these human beings have? Right? And it started out that, well, planting the flag over there, this idea of discovery, right? This, first of all, you have discovery. Well, what rights did the right of discovery give you? Well, back then it was primarily an exclusive right to trade, right? Vis-a-vis any other foreign power. And then eventually this right to trade sort of got converted into right to that land, ultimately. And then, of course, ultimately to, at least in America, and in Central and South America, the destruction of the people, in effect, to take their land and occupy it. But here, I don't know what happened down there. You see, I think what you have going in, say, in Central and South America is some very wild situations, you know, where you have maybe 95% of the land being held by, say, 5% of the people, something to that effect, right? Because they never quite worked out a way, just like America didn't work out much of a way anyway, to deal with the question of those who were there versus those who came. And so you have a revolutionary situation there in El Salvador and other places, Guatemala, where the vast majority of the people are locals, you know, with some mixed bloods, you know, and then the foreigners who now control everything. Here there was no middle ground either, except the reservation form, and all you got left down there is about 50 million acres of land in Indian hands. In the American Revolution, Indians were a military factor. Some fought with the U.S., some fought with the British. Promises of Indian lands were made to soldiers, which created an impetus to secure that land. And in the process, we had the setting up of the first BIA, sort of the Indian Department during the Revolutionary period, which included people like Benjamin Franklin and Patrick Henry, because it was important that they keep the peace with the Indians. There was also a fundamental agreement that Congress should be the repository of Indian policy as opposed to the states. Now, it was argued, you know, by some states, and the degree of exclusivity, that is, how much, you know, control the federal government really had, you know, was sort of argued, but nevertheless there was general consensus in the Continental Congress and thereafter that aspect of public life should be handled by the Congress. Initially the executive, but later on the Congress got intimately involved in every detail of Indian life. And there, of course, there was constant conflict between the settlers, you know, this Indian country, and the home office, right? The states versus the federal government, the frontier versus the developed areas. And, of course, there was a continued development of the idea that the non-Indian world, now wherever the settlers came from, they more or less had a natural right to that Indian land. It was sanctioned by the religion, in effect. And when you go back so far as the 1600s and you read Cotton Mather and some of those other Puritan preachers, they blessed the taking of Indian lands. When they burnt 400 Indians of the Pequot tribe in their town, they justified it on the basis of religion. Let's go back and read it. And of course, that natural right idea sort of stemmed from this idea that the Indians were sort of uncivilized. That is, they couldn't possibly be as human as we, because after all, they don't have any writing system. You know, as far as they're concerned, they didn't have real permanent homes, right? Like built out of solid rock or something. They did not practice agriculture to the extent that the Puritans did. They used what was there. I guess it varied from tribe to tribe, but that was their perception. They also did not enclose the land. It was unfenced. And they did not believe in God, you know, in their God. Right? They believed in supreme beings, but of course the non-Indians, I guess, didn't know that much about it. In short, they were something like savages, like the animals that ran free. And the revolution simply created a further impetus to taking of Indian lands, despite efforts of the federal government to try to maintain a civilized approach to the taking of it. In the final analysis, the government exercised its powers to protect the Indian by removing him, in the Indian removal period. And treaties continued to be used as the vehicle of keeping peace and outlining land cessions to the federal government. They made provision for Indian title, that is, specific lands that were to be owned by the Indians, which lands were to be held in trust for the Indians by the federal government, and made provisions for social or human services in some of those early treaties, that is, so much food, so many blankets, that or another. And for blacksmiths, cattle, utensils, agricultural aid, things of that nature were put in the treaties. In fact, that was sort of the early part of the social service aspects of the federal government that we still have today. And of course for education in schools. And the treaty making ceased in 1871. You make directly with the tribes. So that's what there's a lot happening, of course, say between the 1840, I mean, like the Indian removal period was then, you know, they moved them back towards the Mississippi, beyond the Mississippi, towards the territory. They, in that map you saw, they had, this is the Mississippi, and here was all these bits and pieces of land that they had allocated to the Indians, presumably for as long as the grass shall grow and the river shall flow. And of course, when they found oil on it, they said it didn't include the oil. So, but what happened, of course, the rest of the time was just a continuation, right? To the coast. San Francisco, wherever it is. It was just a continuation of the sort of the same old thing. It just was a continued effort to subjugate the Indian and secure his land. And of course, you had the same similar type force, only moving from the other direction, right? We talked about the Russian advance, 1580 to 1640, thereabouts, the primary period that Siberia was taken for the crown, and it was also a kind of an economic motivation as well, the fur, primarily the sable in Siberia and then otter in Alaska. It took at least 200 years to fully take Siberia because the Chukchis hung out for so long. And even though it only took 60 years to reach the Pacific, you know, down, they didn't come up this direction, they had to come down from here. And the Chukchis held them off. The initial information of Alaska came from the Chukchi in about 1711. Bering's voyage in 1728 was the first one under imperial auspices, where it wasn't just a coincidental thing. The government was trying to find out more about that part of the country, continued the subjugation and the taking of the Yasak, that tribute from the natives, And at that time, in 1728, Bering first located the Diomedes and St. Lawrence Island, but he missed the mainland. And Gvozdyev, in 1732, sighted Alaska near Wales, right at the tip of Seward Peninsula there. And the fur hunters, the Promyshleniki, the ones who kind of came out into Siberia hunting and trading fur, they organized themselves into little companies back then on the basis of shares. And in a capitalistic environment, naturally, the big companies generally get formed. You know, you can't really compete too well in small groups, so the wealthy merchants began to control the trade out there as well. And generally, though, the taking of Siberia sort of happened by sort of an infiltration of Promyshleniki, you know, and Cossack people. And they were kind of a religious people too. Generally, the first sables that were caught were contributed to the church, or to a particular church, kind of a little ceremonial deal. And by the time they came to Alaska, they changed their practices somewhat, because out here, I think it was easy. These alligators were kind of easy. So what they do is before the Russian-American period, they go out to see these little towns out here, little communities, and they coerce them into hunting fur for them. And they'd stay in the village while the men were out hunting and avail themselves of what was available in the village. Of course, if they didn't do it, they shot them, and then until the others started doing it, right? And they did it generally either by agreement or most often by force, because who wants to leave home and, you know, do that? So they went from island to island during that period where you had sort of an unorganized effort on the chain. And supplies were often used to get furs when the natives needed something, because if they couldn't, well, if the men were off doing something else, hunting for somebody else, you know, who would feed people who were there, right? And they use native auxiliaries for both for protection and for hunting. If you recall reading Baranoff, he had 1,000 Aleuts when he first went down to Sitka. Very few Russians, some Creoles, and that was that style was first used on a large scale by Baranoff. I think it's who he's calling him, Baranoff. But the strange thing was that the Russians lived very much like the natives, right? Sort of ate the same food, lived with them, married them, had children by them. There wasn't a class system, really, except insofar as the narrow view between the uncivilized and the civilized natives. But over a period of years, the mixed bloods became, you know, part of the system, right? Captain Etolin, I don't know how they pronounce it, Etolin, was a Creole who eventually, became head of the company, and others, I presume. So between 1740s and 1780s, they had pretty much pioneered, so to speak, the entire Aleutian area. And Shelikov, with the Shelikov-Golikov company, started trading here in 1783. Of course, Baranoff came about, when was it, 1890, something like that. So they had pretty much taken care of that coastal region down there by the 1780s. And in the meantime, the British, French, and English, and Spanish, had sent ships into Southeast Alaska between the 1780s and 90s. It was primarily because of a report that Captain Cook had secured all these fur and sold to China that brought Shelcroft over here. The first and in the meantime, later on, in the early 1800s, began the first voyages into this area by Audubon Kotzebue in 1816. Beechey, the fellow who was Captain Beechey, came expecting the Franklin expedition to have made it, came up into that area. This is all between the first two decades of the 18th century, 1800 to 1830 thereabouts. Shishmaref, Von Kotzebue, Beechey, and those were the first contacts by white Europeans in their ships in this region. The first of many visits. Okay, and it wasn't. Just got to remember. Just try to think of the sequence. By the 1840s, now only 20 some odd years later, they started getting a whole slug of visitors up there when they started doing the whaling. Okay? So you're talking about a hell of a change then, right? In terms of what was in the outside world, people used to think, we were the only ones, right? The real people. We thought we were the only ones, but here all of a sudden in a very few years, you had a whole variety of different people coming up there. Many, many languages, many different, lots of new technology. Okay. Changes were beginning to come about. The first Aleut was baptized in 1759, as early as 1759, into the Orthodox Church. But there wasn't a great deal of missionary activity in the early period of even the Russians. They were just after that fur, primarily, dollars. And in Kodiak, in St. Paul, they had their first chapel built. It is the oldest one in Russian America, 1795. In Sitka, they didn't build one until 1817. And Father Vinaminov, who had probably the most impact on the religious end, began in 1825, became a bishop in 1834. So by 1861, they had, seven churches and 35 chapels scattered throughout various communities along the chain and Prince William Sound and Sitka. Although, from a religious sense, from what I gather, there wasn't a great deal of. It didn't take a lot of the time, right, of the native people. It wasn't something that they leaped into headlong, and it wasn't something that was really pushed as hard. And from the sense of what I gather from reading about Vinaminov, he had the sense to try to do it in their own language, printed materials in the Aleut language. And interestingly enough, when the mixed bloods got an education, they were real practical, and they started teaching astronomy and navigation because of the marine orientation, right? Arithmetic, things like that. Count Razanov, who it was he who
had such a grand vision, I guess I didn't bring that particular book, of what the potential for
Russia was. I mean, you know, he had an entire Pacific conception of what Russia could do insofar as economic activity and control. You know, he had this idea of going all the way down to controlling as much of California as possible, right? And up in the chain, except he ran in and on the Oregon and Washington coast, but running into this American Astor, who was already settled in at Oregon. So they had to settle on down at in Fort Ross, and of course that big massive gold rush in San Francisco kind of screwed up his plans as well, and their phasers in the Hawaiians, right? But can you imagine what this area might have been like if his ideas had managed to bear fruit? Rezanov, who, as you recall, was married to a daughter of Shelikov, who was and he was involved in the court in the Tsar's grounds, so he had influence. But he came to America, and he was very critical of the Russian priests for not doing enough. They weren't as industrious as the Jesuits, he said. As you know, the Jesuits are very, very much, very educated before they get sent off into amongst the people. And he chided them for not learning the local languages. And another problem began to occur. With the arrival of civilization came, of course, disease. In 1836, there was an outbreak of smallpox, starting more than likely from some ships in southeast Alaska, maybe from British Columbia somewhere. They don't know, but in one town, in the town of Tongass, there were 25% of the people died out of 1,000. 250 died. About 50 to 60% of the people, it is reported, died in the region in southeast Alaska. That disease spread more than by ships to the entire coastal areas, to Unalaska and the chain, and spread into the interior, according to this report, decimating entire communities. So much for the blessings of civilization. That was just the first, you know, so the first of the epidemics that began to occur. Okay, in 1867, Russia decided to abandon this place for some reasons, several reasons. They maintained that they never really wanted a colony. You know, as you recall, whoever was the Tsarina at that time says, well, let them go trade. Don't ask for my help, right? She didn't want to get involved. They were interested primarily in the commercial aspects of what was offered in Alaska, somewhat protected by the government. They maintained it was too far away. There was a vast ocean separating the colony. And they said that we needed really to use our forces in another part of the world. Rather than trying to protect Alaska, they need to protect their lands around the Amur from the Chinese. Also, the Russian American Company had been operating under a, what they call a ukase, an imperial order. I don't know how they pronounce it, spell it, but it sounded like. Right, it was something signed by the Tsar. And however, I'm going to find out how Rezanov finally got the half-wit that was Tsar at the time to sign, you know, to give him that monopoly. In any case, they gave him a 20-year, you know, they kept extending it, 20-year monopoly in effect. And I guess they were having problems coming to terms on that last U-case. I think there were some other competitive companies that may have wanted in on the activity in Alaska. But nevertheless, if the Russian-American company wouldn't accept the terms that the government was trying to impose, then what would happen, you know, to Alaska? Also, at this time, of course, America was friendly with the United States. And, of course, America was expanding. You know, that vast explosion of whatever it was that started on the Massachusetts coast, etc., and started moving west, of course, got Americans to believe that they were the chosen people, right? Nothing could stand in their way. All this vast wealth. Of course, they were unrestricted, right? We just discovered in my system here, they had nothing, no qualms about doing anything, right? I mean, there was no driving humane spirit at that. So Mike was right. Anyway, Manifest Destiny was moving them on. They were trying to take over Mexico, or, you know, at least they got having troubles there trying to expand. They got a hold of Texas. They got a hold of Louisiana. And New Mexico area. And also, the Russians wouldn't really let them in here, any of the ports here. But the Russians did use San Francisco and did business, right, with San Francisco, because they had found all that gold there, and they needed ice. So the Russians delivered ice from Sitka and from Kodiak to San Francisco. Business deal. But the Russians knew that the Americans wanted in on the ports, of course, about the time before the sale. And so there were talks about the possible sale of Alaska as early as 1859. And naturally, a senator from California was an instigator, because they could see some potential up there. And he offered the Russians $5 million initially. But Civil War came, interrupted everything. And so it wasn't until after the Civil War that they got down to business again. In fact, the territory of Washington was beginning to be interested in Alaska, because they're right down here, of course, and the Hudson's Bay Company had been moving in. And so the Russians wouldn't allow them to just do business helter-skelter, so they made a deal. The Russians gave them a lease to develop the fisheries in southeast Alaska. So many Washingtonians from Washington Territory were coming up to work in these various canneries and salteries and whatnot. And so Washington wanted to annex it, Alaska, if they could. And they fished for salmon, cod, and halibut. Those were some of the motives why Russia disposed of Alaska. They had other problems, and the company wasn't as profitable. The Russian-American company wasn't as profitable as before. They're running into all that competition. Okay, what about the American motives? Of course, they knew that the oceans and the rivers were prolific in fish. And the Russian government wasn't hot to trot at that point to renew the charter. The countries were friends. They wanted to prevent the transfer of Alaska to any other unfriendly power, whoever that might be, England or somebody, Spain or France, I don't know who was that interested. They also had industrial interest in the Pacific. and were interested in the supremacy in the Pacific. And
to some extent, commerce with China and Japan.
Those were reasons that they came up with afterwards, I think. But it was a very vast land that was not really owned by either. In reality, it was
this whole land was transferred from one European race to an offshoot of another.
Right? They didn't really own it. However, within a matter of weeks, there were flocks of speculators, politicians, office hunters, tradesmen, laborers, prostitutes, loafers, gamblers arrived in Sitka.
Such was what comprised the American West.
Can you imagine that? I mean, can you imagine how it might have been? I'd like to read an account of how those... See, there were some Russians still left there, right? And they'd been kind of a... somewhat of a leisurely pace in the old style where the governor of Russian America was the law. Well, they had courts back in Kamchatka, you know, across the ocean, but the kindly governor had run things with a pretty firm hand. Indians didn't really get out of hand. They had, knew how to deal with them. And everybody respected law and order. And then here comes this wild bunch of people, in effect. So there was quite a great change, you know, in the perception of the occupiers, right? Those who were now the new people, presumably in control. And I would love to have heard some reactions from the Indian side. You know, we don't see anything, right? We're always getting it from bits and pieces from the outsiders, but you never really see what happened from how the Indians perceived what was happening. According to Bancroft, the Indians were really teed off. You know, not so much because of these other non-Indians there, it was because they didn't get the money, right? They said, we just let Baranoff here. We made a deal with him to his little piece of property, but this is our land. And where's our money? And of course, speculation and lawlessness abounded. It's no wonder that all but a dozen Russians left for Russia. They had that option, you know, 5 years. And presumably a lot of them kind of had in mind to stay because this was their home. But as it turns out, when Prince Maksudov left, the last of the heads of the company, he had twice the number of people on his ship that he really should have had. He had about 300 people. They were supposed to have maybe 150, but everybody saw what was happening. They said, my God, I got to get out of here. So 5 years later, after 1867, Sitka was down to nothing more than a few Creoles, a few soldiers, and about 20 American civilians, some Aleuts and some whatever, yeah, Creoles. I mean, everything went downhill. Yeah.
That's the 200 soldiers of Japanese.
Yeah. The military, the army, was sent in and stayed there for how many years? 7 years? Yeah, they went off to fight Chief Joseph in Idaho after. But in reality, there was no civil government, you know. It was simply a military protectorate, so to speak. And primarily in southeast of Alaska, you know. They never really set up anything anywhere else. The military was there supposed to protect the American citizens and the Russians, you know, that were left there. In fact, there was some substantial complaints being made to Russia because the United States wasn't carrying out its promises to protect the people. And but there was no law, American law, no civil justice of any type. There was no way that you could make a will or convey your mining claim or even secure the land you're on unless it was already conveyed by some Russian deed of some type. And criminals would go unpunished. And the situation in Sitka deteriorated with the presence of the troops there. According to the, it was just a complete change of scene. This, just the whole tone of what was happening.
Didn't they have the first legislative act for Alaska was the Customs Act?
Yes.
That made customs.
Made a customs district out of it. Yeah.
Which district from military to the government system.
Yeah, token. That's right. Absolute token. So there was lust, theft, and drunkenness, according to these books I read, both amongst white and Indians alike. The garrison was in the heart of town, right, the fort where the people were. And of course, they had night passes, right? They could go anywhere at night. It was one of the problems. There was very lax control. The officers were weak. There were 500 soldiers in Alaska in about 1870 or so. But they only needed a gunboat, really, to protect themselves from Indians if they needed to, because the Indians were afraid of the destruction that could be had by gunboats. But there were more problems with Indians during that period than any other time before, when the troops were there. But the only positive thing I read is that the natives could receive higher prices for their pelts still from the Americans like they did earlier. Some incidences that were written about during that time with respect to the hostilities involved a Chilkat Indian being shot for breaking a glass of a showcase in somebody's store. There's a big long story about that, how they went and got him. Three people were wounded over breaking of an egg that this Indian lady was bartering with a soldier for, and he broke it and she wanted payment for it. And that caused a scuffle, and some Indians got onto him and they went and caused a big shooting. A chief went aboard a steamer to be a witness in a case of a military prisoner, and he was so poorly treated that he committed suicide, almost caused a big war between that little tribe and there. The troops were withdrawn in 1877, but there was no Indian outbreak. And of course, liquor was doing its damage. The Russians did not give the Indians booze unless it was a special occasion. But they did make Alaska Indian country in 1873 insofar as liquor was concerned. Only liquor, Indian country. They designated it Indian country. They revoked all permits for sale of liquor. But of course it had limited effect because the bootlegging of liquor by traders was too lucrative. Right? They still went around bartering for furs, selling booze and whatever else. And of course they made hoochinoo from molasses, flour, rice or dried apples and yeast. It was a scourge of Southeast, I guess. In terms of any type of American government, besides the acquisition by the idea of acquiring the territory by Washington, somebody thought they ought to make it a county of Washington, a county of a territory. Now that would have been something. And of course the settlers that were there, they kept blaming the lack of progress on the fact that there was no government. They said they needed a court and they needed land laws, which they didn't have any land laws. Fortunately, for the Indians, of course, as late as 1883, there was only a customs district, and the only laws that were applied to the Alaska were laws of the, or the regulations of the Secretary of Treasury. And the Russian American Company was sold to some San Francisco business people. They began to call it the Alaska Commercial Company. They made arrangements to acquire the properties of the old Russian American Company. And what they were primarily interested in was, as it turns out, was the seal islands, that is the Pribilof Islands, and the fur seal. And that, if you will read history, was a, there are volumes upon volumes of work done on the fisheries, I mean on the seal, rookeries rather, because the Russian American Company did gain control of them. Survival was eliminated. In fact, I think they were brought out there from the mainland. Yeah, somebody had their hand up. Yeah.
When you were talking about the unrest of the Indians, I have another course, and teacher told us that when they went down to fight the Nez Perce with Chief Joseph, the only person left was the customs official, and he took off for a year. So there was nobody American that was running America, this part of America. So the people of Sitka wrote a letter to the British government and asked for protection.
That's right.
And they sent the HMS Osprey up.
That's right.
For a month. It protected That's them until American, the USS Alaska came up.
That's right. In fact, they didn't even come under using the proper diplomatic channels, mm-hmm. as it turns out. Yeah. So, after numerous petitions, they finally got some civil government. And by that time, 1882, Sitka was down from about 1,000 people to about a little over 500. Most of whom were Indian, of course. And so, they got government, right? If nothing was happening, they always blamed the... Nothing wasn't happening, they always blamed the government. So, they got an act through which... allowed for the appointment of a governor who would also act as the chief magistrate, as a judge. They made Sitka the temporary capital. The governor reported to the president of the United States. They have established a district court, established a clerk of the court who functioned as a secretary and treasurer of the district. Well, see, they didn't even make it a territory. Right. The clerk of the court was also the recorder of deeds, mortgages, etc. They provided for a marshal and some deputies, functioning under the laws of Oregon. They also created a land district with a land office at Sitka. But they did not apply the general land laws of the United States, just the mining laws. And the Secretary of Interior was to establish a commission to, number one, examine the condition of the Indians. What lands were to be left to their use? What provisions for education to be made? And what rights of the lands occupied by the settlers should be recognized? In reality, what you had was a the beginning of the stealing of the land, because presumably the Americans figured that they had bought the entire state, right, or the entire land mass, right?
Didn't the Organic Act specifically say that the land for use and occupied by the natives?
Yes, that's true, but in the process they validated claims that were made illegally, right, between 1867 and 1884. So while they did not convey any specific rights, you know, to native people to secure land, it verified the rights of the whites, right, to the mining claims that they had made, as well as presumably whatever lands that they might have secured that were transferred by the Russians. Yeah. The Organic Act of 1884? In the case book, it's fairly extensive. You want to look at it there. Yeah, David Case's book. But it was a specific act of Congress. And in that, of course, it did specify that Indians, Eskimos, and Aleuts would be protected in their use and occupation of lands or any lands claimed by them. You see, but this was pretty much ignored. I mean, who was going to enforce a law against the white man, right?
And that was also for whenever Congress in the future decided on what land.
Right. Yeah. Okay, presumably the Americans felt that they had also, just as during the Revolution, they had defeated the British and therefore acquired whatever rights the British may have had from the Indians, right, in terms of their contact. Presumably the Americans felt that they had secured the right to do whatever needed to be done to secure that land for themselves. But during the congressional debates, the proponents of the acquisition of Alaska claimed that they had no intent to disturb the rights of the native people. And of course, what began to happen was the discovery of gold, right? In the Yukon Territory, there was a massive rush there from the Klondike. Not too long thereafter, up in the interior, early 1900, 1902. In the Nome area, 1898. In fact, you know, by 1900, which wasn't too many years after the purchase, 20,000 people descended on Nome there. The people who found it, I think, had been reindeer herders. Some from Scandinavia. So, what began to occur was a drastic reduction because of the influx of people in the ability of the native people to survive. And I think you should remember that insofar as the Organic Act was concerned, they did not extinguish any native title, right? In fact, they confirmed it, right? You know, when we talked about the idea of extinguishment of Indian title, it had to be a specific act of Congress, not simply assumed. Well, they didn't extinguish any claims the natives might have had.
I have a question. If they were in the continental U.S., they're just pushing the Indians
Well, I suppose it wasn't as attractive to farm. It wasn't like the great, you know, Mississippi Valley or something that they needed, you know, that had a great crops, you know, farming up here. Yeah.
Probably by this time, since it wasn't that attractive, the conscience was sort of caught up with again.
Oh, are you kidding? Don't give me that. It has not caught up with us yet.
No, but I mean, it's some token. It was yeah.
I suppose, maybe. Okay, the Russians had acknowledged that they had not endeavored to change the natives' way of land tenure, you know, even after the sale. And, of course, most Indians and Eskimos were unaware of the sale, except the Russian-American Company had sent word, you know, to all their outposts along the coast, but course, the word, I'm sure, didn't get into the interior. What? So what? You know, they didn't know anything about it. Most tribes were unaffected by the sale in their land use during the first 10 years, even in Southeast Alaska, for that matter. But the pressure was on. Between 1880 and 1900, the non-natives increased from 430 to 34,000, right, in just a 20-year period. And the natives declined from 33 to 29. And the Congress began a series of moves to allow securing of title by the government. That is, they gave the Metlakatlans land, right? They also made provisions for town sites under the public land laws, specific town sites, also for trade and manufacturing sites. And they also gave the president authority to set aside reserves for forests, i.e. the Tongass area, eventually the McKinley, and also the Chugach forests. These were very early on, subsequent. So what was the legal relationship of the native people then? You know, to the United States, kind of fuzzy, right?
What's that ridiculous thing about the 160-acre parcels that they never did
productivity? Oh yeah, we can get into that. It's the Indian Allotment Act. Well, yeah, in relation to what was happening in the 1880s, you recall that Dawes Act?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was in 1884 too, or 87 was it? I forget. 84. It was applied to Alaska in 1906. That was the Americanizing process. You know, that's where they were disintegrating the land to hopefully to disintegrate the Indian, right, to make an American out of him. And of course that was applied to Alaska. But insofar as our legal relationship, well, they were not citizens of the United States, were they? Presumably they were citizens of their own tribes, own communities. And I suppose in the view of Americans, insofar as the treaty was concerned, the natives were considered uncivilized on the whole, as opposed to civilized, you know, the dependent or independent. So most uncivilized natives, or the civilized ones, had an opportunity to go back to Russia if they wanted to, especially because most of them were Creoles, right? And next time, I want to, whenever the next time is, wait a minute. Next time we're going to have a test. And the time after that, we're going to have a visitor. I'm going to have John Shively come and speak. He's presently on his way to Greenland in Canada with the rest of our people, but he has been executive vice president of the Alaska Federation of Natives. He's been working with Native groups since he was a WISTA volunteer, and did most of the lobbying on the D2 legislation for the Native community. So he'll be here on the 2nd.
Pessimistic. And I do know that living in a data set which has not been lived before, and in a set which makes sort of conflicting demands upon the occupant, is a painful one for the occupant. But it provides us with new challenge and opportunities, and out of redefinition of the various